guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick, as we've done for 35 years. Curious radio amateurs who want to know more about their equipment and how it works, they gather here on Sunday evenings, and they get some of those questions answered. The price is right. Information is not guaranteed to always be accurate, but eventually the errors can correct it. Becomes a sort of peer-reviewed because the last 10 and a fraction years of the TechNet have been recorded. Very enthusiastic guy, KC2NJI, Mike Perry. You can read all the past TechNets by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. There's also another website that supports the TechNet, done by Mike number 2, K1MJM. And that's LimeOcTechNet.com. So those two websites give you additional information about what goes on in the TechNet graphs, things like the Brown and Woodward curves that I mentioned so often, where you can predict the impedance of any length, any diameter of a dipole or a monopole-like structure. Let me drop. And those Brown and Woodward curves are so valuable because that's real measured data, as opposed to there's a whole bunch of people's curve emulating equations that only work over a certain portion of that data and don't work on other portions. There was an electronic design news article recently where somebody has a formula that predicts the amount of capacitance you get out of a monopole of various diameters and various lengths. And the equation is quite wrong. It predicts the wrong information. Let me drop. Along those lines, if Joe signs in tonight, W2RYY, he asked a set of interesting questions last week. I did a couple of calculations, and the answers are kind of surprised to what's really going on in one of those so-called bug signal injection or signal monitoring devices. What's really going on inside of there is kind of surprising. Hearing more about that if Joe happens to sign in tonight. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment by giving us name, call letters, name, probably in that order, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You don't need a long list of people signing in because they're listening. After 35 years, we believe somebody is listening. Let me drop. And after our question and answer period, we'll be going over to Paul, WS2N, with our space report. And tonight's space report will be 262, that number of the series, which Paul will bring us up to date on what's going on with NASA and all the other space agencies. So, at this time, we're going to take chickens. If you've got a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. And try to remember for giving enough space in between to hear all four beeps so we don't time out the machine. K2RIW listening.
N2HUH. For the question, November 2, Hotel United Hotel.
W2RIY Joe. Yes, with a comment.
Okay, we've got N2HUH. Better known as Andy, he didn't tell us that. Go of W2RYY. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. One more call. Anyone to check into the TechNet because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. T2RYW listening.
WS2N Paul with the space report, but no questions right now. Back to you, sir.
Okay, glad to hear from you, Paul. You're sounding good tonight. Okay, Andy, you're number one on the runway. You're allowed to ask anything, except about antennas, and that's a joke. My favorite subject, N2HUH, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Good evening, Richard and Annette. Well, many a truth is said in jest, so I won't ask an antenna question, but I have two questions to basically the same topic, though. The first question is going to be about if anybody on the Y Mark is or listening is familiar with Mike's Train House being led to believe that it's not worth trying to get this repaired or otherwise, because it's a very bad Title IV type technology that's doomed to fail, and in my opinion anyway, and there's problems with it, so it may not be worth repairing professionally, so to speak. I want to know if anybody else could advise me from their experiences of getting such an item repaired, or do you just forget about it and go forward?
On a quick question there, Andy, Mike's train house train, is that HO gauge, or give us a couple words as to what kind of a train this is. I presume it's an electric model railroad train, and my first guess was HO gauge. Go ahead.
I believe, no, this would be actually O27 or O gauge, and their computer system is known as PS2 or PS3 now, is you can control them digitally, and like DCS they call it, and they have recorded sounds that sound realistic. They're cab chatter and real steam engine sounds and chuffing and whistles and horns and on and on and on. But they ran fine a year or two ago, and now it doesn't work, and they say it does have a type of Fatal 4 that may have to be reprogrammed, or but it's beyond that. I believe I felt the control trip really overheating and got very hot, so I think it's doomed. But I just wanted advice as to whether it's cost effective to get that repaired, or should I turn it into a forward reverse type of engine with another circuit. That's part two of my question for later. Back to that.
Okay, bit of an unusual question. First time we've ever had one on this subject, Andy. So Mike's train house train, probably 027 gauge, maybe a defective PS2 controller. Anybody have any words as to how Andy can make this thing work better? Possibly repair it, maybe replace that chip. What does he have to give up? And one last question, Andy. Is this a currently manufactured object, or is the manufacturer no longer there, and therefore maintenance and finding spare parts is very difficult? N2HUH with some further information, K2LIW on the TechNet.
I think the older system, PS2, is parts run available, and you have to upgrade to PS3, and then even if they sent me a board for a good couple of $100s, which is, you know, substantial, and I don't use a digital control system, I really don't. I just run trains for the kids or whatever. But when you slap the board in, then you have to have it programmed for the sounds, or for steam, if it's a steam train, steam sounds, a freight, passenger sounds, and or diesel sounds or whatever. So then you have to go through that. So basically, it's a two-part sequence, which seems like a lot, or really a lot to do. Get a train running on a track. Yeah, I have 15, 60-year-old Lionel engines that still run fine with a little tender care from me. They still run fine. This thing is like a total basket case into H2H.
Yeah, you probably have a philosophy somewhat like mine, Andy. I get a great enjoyment out of fixing things. The rig you're listening to right now is a Kenwood TS711, 2-meter all-mode, 30-watt output capable. It's a, I am guessing it's 1985 vintage, but I really like this piece of equipment. I've owned a number of them. I've repaired their power supplies, their power output transistor, and so on, power output assembly. So, opening up the package and troubleshooting it and fixing it, if it's something you own, and as long as you're not dealing with high voltages, then getting in there and trying to do a repair can be a fun thing to do. You don't violate the warranty on something that's that many years old. There is no warranty. So, with reference to Andy's Mike's Train House Train, 027 gauge, relatively rare subject by our standards. Anybody got any further comments as to how Andy can get this repaired? And possibly, is there a substitute controller chip that he could put in there, the one that's running hot and giving him trouble? If anybody's got any information along these lines, or even knows somebody that's got further information and can pass that name and call letters on to Andy, please give us your input right now. K2RIW listening for all those thousands of answers we're going to get on this one. Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid of this one, Andy. Maybe we're not getting an answer on this one. Let's see, we've got various nets on LIMOC for things like computers.
Nick, was this Lionel?
Let's find that out. Andy, go right ahead. Is that a Lionel product? I'm a little bit afraid it might not be. You got it, Andy.
No, it's Mike's Treehouse, and I was having a brief conversation this morning with a nice fellow here that said they don't want to, that I shouldn't even be bothered trying to get it repaired, but I just wanted a second opinion from somebody, maybe a member of LIMOC or somebody who listens to the TechNet, might have a little experience under their belt on Mike's Treehouse trains when the PS2 or the proto board goes bad. Is it worth upgrading to a PS3 or attempting to, because I don't even think they repair the PS2 anymore. I think they just automatically upgrade to a PS3. That's pretty much all the information I have. And the company is not, my train now is not very cooperative from what I hear.
Do you have any further suggestions, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I just did a Lionel doing business. I don't know, maybe he wants to take a picture of the board and let's see what it looks like and go from there.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. A picture of the board. Is there a way of finding out the manufacturer of that control chip, Andy? Also, though it doesn't really matter, the train that you're talking about, I'm presuming it's an engine, what do you believe is the brand new price? Over you, Andy, N2HUH, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, when I purchased it, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, it was probably from Sears, discontinued or something for a couple hundred dollars, ready to run set. Now the engine itself can sell new used from anywhere from $200 to $400, but the system that it has, the Proto Sound 2 system has got a fatal flaw glitch in it that can actually cause it to fail. That's why they upgrade to a slightly better, unsupported, made-to-fail system, PS3, which costs $200 for that board, and then you have to send it or bring it somewhere or buy something expensive to program it for all the sounds and chatter and noise that it makes.
I think I heard somebody say that they've got a comment or a suggestion. Who was that?
K2GJE.
Okay, Mr. K2GJE. Go right ahead with your information, sir.
Place in Ronkonkoma called Long Island Railroad. I don't know if they sell parts or do repairs, over.
Andy, does that sound new to you?
Yes, don't want to go crazy out of my way. There's also a place called Train Land in not too far from Valley Stream. I forgot what town it's in. If it is Valley Stream, I don't even know. I don't remember. But where they filmed the episode of The Sopranos where Bobby Bacala gets wiped out, which I liked watching that episode. But anyway, that's a season finale anyway, but he bought the an $8,000 Lionel tin plate of Blue Comet. But anyway, I can take it there too, but like I said, I think that you have to go, you gotta pay pay big bucks and go and jump through hoops to get the thing finally running again. That's why I want some maybe seasoned advice on this situation.
WS2N.
Go ahead, hit Paul.
I ride past that Long Island. They've been there for decades, but I haven't seen them in the last year or two. Many years ago, I went inside, and they had, complete setup, buy anything you want. But whether or not they're still there, I would call ahead. I see there's a violin service place there where somebody apparently teaches violin. Maybe somebody else moved in there. Maybe they're still there, but their big sign is gone. Back to you, Dick.
K2TGW.
Very fine, Paul. K2TGW. I think that's Les. Hope you got some better information for Andy. Les, K2TGW, K2LIW in the group.
Well, as of last I passed, they are open. It's an old family business. I know they're still open. It's in Lynbrook, just east of the railroad overpass on Sunrise Highway.
Okay, that's encouraging. Sure, it'd be nice if on eBay or Amazon or any of these other places we'd be selling you used, discarded, repairable equipment with reference to this product of yours, Andy. I guess that's a long shot because this is a relatively rare item, and the few people who've got it probably think it's gold and want real high prices. Is that sort of what you're running into, Andy? And I think there's a medium chance if you take a photograph of that PC board with enough resolution and mail that to Eric, get all kinds of crazy contacts. He may know somebody that can help you replace that main controller integrated circuit chip. N2HUH, K2LIW.
Okay, I may do that. I may just do that. Although it's a two-layer board, I have to start desoldering to get the second layer. But all right, but that, when I say control chip, I mean, I can't be sure if that's the control chip, or I didn't do enough research on it, or that's the program chip that might have to be replaced and still have to be programmed, so I'm not sure which, but I'll see if I can, I can't find that, I'll send Eric a picture, and thank you for that offer. And the second part of my question is, let me let it drop for a second. Because I already took the board out, so I can't take a picture of it or put it to anything I want with it. And I wanted to take on the board there's a projector flyer that's less than an inch in diameter, a small one. And I took one that's three sizes larger, one of these projector flyers, although it was used from a junk box. And, it's an inch and a half in diameter, aluminum, nice heavy duty projectifier. I soldered it on the leads and put it on the track and thought I can run the train forward and just have fun with it that way with the kids. But the power supply, it really wasn't running too well, and it was barely moving, creeping along, and then I'm overloading the transformer. So I'm not sure if that bridge rectifier is no good, it's defective, or I can't think of any reason why the train shouldn't have ran like that when in the engine, from the factory, it has a tiny bridge rectifier in there as opposed to the large one that I put in. Any ideas why it wasn't working or just a defective component?
Yeah, there are various ways you can test a bridge rectifier. With low voltages from a digital voltmeter to real voltages. And you have reason to believe, Andy, that the electric motor is in good working order. If the electric motor itself had a shorted turn in either its armature or its rotor or stator, if there was a shorted turn, the electric motor would run slow when you gave it the right amount of voltage and it would draw extra current. So feeding voltage directly to the motor and confirming that it runs at a reasonable speed and doesn't get hot by way of divide and conquer, that may give you some additional information. So what evidence do you have that the motor itself is in good working order, Andy? N2HUH, K2IW.
Well, when I held it in my hand and I put 12 volts on it from the 2-amp power supply, it ran like a bat out of hell with no problem. And then when I put it on the put it on the track with that bridge rectifier, with that load on it, that weight, the load of the engine, it almost doesn't want to move. It creeps, and it just seems the power supply just overheats. So I don't understand that unless it's under load. That bridge rectifier is defective, and it didn't get hot either, though. But from what I could feel, it did not get warm. When it was running like a bat out of hell, it didn't get warm. So that I didn't understand at all. Is the one that's on the small circuit port from the factory, that bridge rectifier is like one quarter the size of the one that I use. So that didn't make any sense to me.
He has some capacitance on the output of the bridge.
Yeah, I know about that. It's true, but that's what I need. I got to add capacitors to the bridge.
Andy, when you feed the motor directly, and I presume you're feeding it AC voltage, not DC voltage, because that could give a very big difference in the way it performs. You know the way the track normally feeds voltage into the wheels of the train through that bridge rectifier. So if you now go the next step and feed your power supply directly into the wheels of the train, even though it's not under load, does the motor still run happy through that bridge rectifier into that motor when you feed the voltage through the wheels so that it's going through that bridge? That's another test I think you could try, Andy. N2HUH, K2RIW.
Yeah, I did that. It ran like a bat out of hell. With no load on the wheels. I didn't weigh about 4 pounds. I put that on the track, it doesn't move. Basically, it overloads the power pack that the set comes with. But the power pack is fine. It runs on the train. It's fine. No problem.
Okay, the next thing that I would try, when it's under load, under normal load, engine with maybe a couple of cars, and you're feeding it from the track, there's probably a way you can put some extra wires on the motor to confirm that from the track, running with your normal track power supply, that the right amount of voltage is getting to the motor. So that would be testing the bridge rectifier and the whole circuit under real working conditions. A couple of test leads on the motor coming out of the train, going to your digital voltmeter, and find out, is the right voltage getting to the motor through the whole system with the current bridge rectifier? That's one of the things I would try at this time, Andy. N2HUH, K2RIW.
Done with a comment.
Okay, somebody said comment. Give us your call letters, name, and go right ahead with your comment, sir.
Thank you, Dick. This is Rich, WB2GXM, Golf X-Ray Mike. Andy, you say that your locomotive runs fine, not on the track, with no load on it. When you put it on the track, it stops. That would suggest to me to be a mechanical problem, maybe cleaning up the insides of the locomotive, cleaning up the gears and re-greasing them, making sure everything is copacetic, etc. WB2GXM.
You got it, Andy. And if I know Andy, he's already tried some of those things. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, it's not that. If I use a 12-volt power supply and I try to load it down with my fingers, it's running like a bat out of hell. But on the track, for some reason, it just doesn't like it. And other trains run fine on the track with the same transformer and track. So, and I just... the only thing I can think of is the circuit board does have a couple, what I call small large capacitors. Maybe that would help somehow. And another hint that I had was when I started up slowly, the wheels move and the engine starts to move, but as I increase the power or the voltage, all of a sudden, that's when the power supply circuit breaker opens. But yet, with a regular old-fashioned Lionel train or anything else on a track, I can't even go full throttle and it runs fine, or even a Mike's train, house train runs fine on that same system. So correct. Well, I didn't have time to really. Only half an hour before the net is when I finished up and then started scratching my head. So, back to that.
That is an amazing set of circumstances that don't quite hang together. Voltage directly to the train by way of its wheels, its sliders on the track, through the bridge rectifier, into the motor. Even with the wheels up, being held back with your fingers, it's working like a charm. And yet, through the real transformer that's feeding the track, this particular train doesn't work well where other trains do. And I guess you've measured the voltage getting to the track under the working conditions with this train present. Suggests it's drawing a lot of current. Measuring the voltage getting to the track, measuring the current getting to the track. How in the world does it draw so darn much current when it's sitting right side up on the track, and yet I am guessing you're holding it upside down when you feed the voltage directly to the wheels. I wonder if any of these things give you any hints, Andy, as to something that could be changing as a function of gravity and whether or not the train is right side up or upside down. N2HUH, K2RIW.
You know what it is? It epitomizes my call sign, huh? I'm pretty capable. I repair a lot of things, and I'm very successful. I mean, my heating system is 60 years old, so you know, I do pretty good real life, real world events. I mean, like my cars were. I never had a car that was less than 10 years old, and right now my car, most cars I had were 20 years old, and I keep them running fine. The point is that this one here, huh? anything odd like this is just there's always these setbacks and odd circumstances that I don't know why, but I don't want to belabor the point. I'll do some more investigating, and I'm not even sure if it's worth it. But I like learning. I'm a seeker of knowledge, and the saga continues. N2HUH.
Comment, please. Okay, comment, please. Who is that? Give us your call letter's name and proceed with your comment.
Roger, Dick, this is Mike. Mike number 2, Kilo 1, Mike, Juliet, Mike. I just turned the radio on. I don't know the whole story yet, but I would like to clarify something. If it's a Mike Trainhouse or Lionel locomotive, it's usually a constant voltage on the track, and you're controlling the speed of the locomotive with a signal that goes over the track, telling the controller what to do. So if you're running on a 12-volt power supply, you could very well change the speed and make it run like you want it to without using the controller. Kilo 1, Mike Juliet, Mike, we're clear. Back over to you, Dick.
Yeah, you got the right product. Mike Train, House Train. Let's see if Andy has any further words on what you just said. You got an N2, huh, HUH? Go ahead, Andy, K2RIW.
Nope, like I said, a 50-year-old Lionel train runs fine with the horn. The 60-year-old, what is it, a post-war? No, the pre-war steam engine with the real whistle in it runs fine. Mike's train house train runs fine. That's it, I have three engines. That's it, I'm finished, I shot my load. Three engines, the fourth one here, the proto sound engine doesn't run, and I modified it just recently, for half an hour before the net to run on off a regulator, and it doesn't run on the same track. So, you're not telling me anything I don't know, but the point is that it was part two of my question, why that train wasn't running with a large bridge rectifier inside it.
Mike number 2, sounds like you own one of these things, so give us some further words on your experience. K1MJM and the group, K2RIW.
Roger, Dick, I own a couple of them. I'm not a big user of them, but I did play with the DCC, the digital command stuff a few years back. Again, I don't have a layout or anything like that, so I don't have a lot of knowledge. But like I said, I do know that they run on constant voltage. You don't vary the voltage. You send a signal over the track to a controller in the locomotive, and that changes the speed. You can run most of them on variable voltage, but that's a whole different setup. But that's pretty much all I really know. Back over to you, Dick.
I am curious, Mike. You're giving it a constant voltage on the track. The command you give it adjusts the speed. Does that mean the controller is doing something like a pulse width modulation to change the average voltage the actual motor on the engine gets? Is that somewhat how it works? Because I'm having trouble believing that we'd use anything like a rheostat, which would run hot. K1MJM and the group, K2RIW.
No, Dick, it's actually a signal that's telling the controller what to do. You can have multiple trains on the same track and run them all at different speeds and different directions and change speeds and directions without affecting the other ones because of the digital, what they call digital command system. It's actually sending an addressable command over the rail to the individual locomotive.
Superimposed on the AC voltage on the track.
Make a comment before we go any further.
Yeah, I want to first find out from Mike number two, if I give a command for it to run slower, how does the controller on that engine lower the voltage getting to that electric motor? Is it a pulse width modulation on the train itself? Over to you, Mike number one. Mike number two.
I believe it is pulse width modulation controlled on the locomotive itself. There are controller boards, aftermarket ones you can buy also, that do the same thing. Both Lionel and Mike's Train House, I don't know if they're interchangeable or not, but they both do the same thing.
Pulse width modulation.
Yeah, Andy wants to make a comment, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Andy.
If you want to, we could talk about this all night. Maybe I'll use DCC. The system he's talking about is DCC, and I don't use that system. So that's a different system. I'm not using that. And my system, the transformer, changes voltage. It goes from 5 volts to 21 volts, so AC. So the system he's talking about, yes, you can use that, but that's not the system I'm using. Back to net.
Very fine. Eric, you've got it. Wait for the beeps.
In relation to what was being said, I'm on the Lionel website, and there's a little article here about incorporating the Lionel command control system into it. They basically say, remove any previous wires that exist as a coil or wires bunched up. It interferes with the pigeons could create a manic block of the radio signal, so there's your little bit of clue. So obviously the Lionel model stuff has some sophistication. I mean, some of the products that they show for today is unbelievable. And then there's another little bit that says how to convert DC-only locomotives to operate on AC, blah, blah, blah. But it sounds like what Andy's system, the old system that I still have, 027 gauge, it's purely AC, and it's, you know, the transformer sends out. It's actually a tapped auto transformer. When you move the handle, you're changing the tap on the transformer, so you get the idea.
You've had that in your possession, Eric, since you were a youngster. I bet you've had that for, what, 30 years?
Well, I've had it. It was in my bedroom as a kid. My dad made this thing that when you would go to sleep, you would actually push it up against the wall. When you got up and you wanted to play with it, you would lay it down. It was held by a couple of pieces of guy wire, so to speak, on the left and right-hand side of it. And I'd say it's probably around 50-something years old.
Is yours approximately that age, Andy? Over to you, Andy.
I don't understand the question, Dick. I have a Lionel transformer. I have a Mike Trainhouse transformer. I have Lionel train, two engines. I have two Mike Trainhouse trains, and one of them is broken. I don't use the DCC, the S system, the sophisticated system, although the broken engine that I'm referring to is adaptable to that system. I don't use that system. I use a standard variable voltage tap transformer, and that's it. So I'm using the old style transformer, and all the trains run fine on that, except this Proto Sound 2 engine that I'm asking the different questions about.
Okay, you're going to have to be doing some troubleshooting. Anybody have any further suggestions on how Andy can troubleshoot the symptoms that he's recognized so far. Any further suggestions? Give me a call with us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. We're curious. You've got our curiosity up, Andy. As you go further with your troubleshooting and you eventually find out what's going on, come back and let us know what you found. And who cares if it's old? And most people, we live in a throwaway society where a lot of people just throw things away the very first time it hiccups. I don't agree with that. I take them apart and troubleshoot them. No matter how old it is, no matter how little value it has today, I like keeping things working. That's me. And Andy has some of that characteristic, I believe. Eric does also. Lots of you guys do. The next person on our list was Joe, W2RYY. I got a lot of information for you, Joe, but you had some comments you want to make first. Go right ahead. W2RYY. 2RIW. You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good, Dick. The comment was about the project they worked on a couple weeks ago, working on a GR500 repeater made by Motorola, which essentially it's a very simple flight controller controlling two mobile radios, one being a receiver, one being a transmitter, and having a notch duplexer in between to get them to work properly off a single antenna. Initially, I had a problem with descent, which turned out to be a bad cable. One of the cables I had supplied to me was bad. You could actually move the connector at one end, one of the end connectors. So when I got both cables replaced, actually three cables replaced, it seemed to solve the problem. And I did hear you talk about that last week about, I think it was last week, you made a comment about somebody else about this, when you're checking something with an open load compared to having a 50 ohm load on it. The duplexer was tuned with a service monitor with good quality cables. I think I used quarter inch superflex cables coming and going to the service monitor with 60 dB pads. And I got the duplexer to tune and give me about 90 dB of isolation on each side. Reset. When I put the duplexer in service with these two radios, I didn't get that kind of isolation. And how I determined this was I took the radios and programmed each radio to the alternate frequency it's not supposed to be using. In other words, the receiver, I programmed that to receive the transmit frequency, and the transmitter I programmed to receive the receive frequency. So as I put a signal in from the antenna input, I could go on the transmitter radio and dial up the receive frequency on that radio, and I could actually measure the notch depth that I was supposed to be getting through the duplexer. And instead of me getting 90, it actually went down as low as 75. One of the other side was like about 80. And what I did to counter that was I tweaked the knobs on the duplexer, and it goes against my grain doing that, of course. That's not what I was, originally taught how to do these things. But it did improve the isolation back and forth. So apparently the duplexer's tuning, when looking at a 50 ohm load, with like an attenuator pad, on each of the ports, and a 50 ohm port, 50 ohm load to center, on the alternate port that you're not tuning, compared to the receiver itself, it does change apparently the way the duplexer seems to work. So after we retweaked it, I got just about my 90 dB of isolation, and my descent went down significantly. Initially, before I retweaked it, I had about maybe my timer went off. Initially, before I retweaked it, I had about maybe 8 dB of descents, a lot better than 18 dB of descents I had with the bad cables. But after I retweaked it, it went down about maybe 3 or 4 dB of descents, and I would expect that to probably be pretty good for a pair of mobile radios and running a notch duplexer only that have no pass characteristics on it at all. So that basically ends that project. I finished it, and it's done. It seems to work a lot better than when I started with. Back to you.
Yeah, there are at least two important characteristics that you're now indicating. Number one, no matter what kind of a filter mechanism you've got, like a duplexer, diplexer, and so on, bandpass filter, when you tune it with 50 ohm loads, the ideal way, you'll get a certain performance. When you put that filter assembly into the real world, where at various frequencies it sees something different than 50 ohms, the filter will move. The notch frequency will move, the passband frequency will move, the ripple in the passband will move. So to retweak, to do a minor amount of retweaking of a filter when it's installed in the real environment, you've now got two choices. Either try to do something with the environment to make it look like 50 ohms, improve the tuning of the antenna or putting in pads in funny places or whatever. Finding out why there's standing wave ratio on any of the ports of the filter assembly to try to make it look like 50 ohms is a direct approach. The indirect approach is minor tweaking of the duplexing filter, hoping to get better performance when it's installed. So that's factor number one. I remember now what factor number two is I was going to mention. So things change an awful lot. Oh yeah, the method by which you inject signals in order to measure isolation. In your case, you did it direct by tuning one of the receivers to the transmit frequency, for instance. You now are measuring how much real feed-through power you're getting, assuming the transmitter is being properly loaded by that arrangement. That's a realistic measurement. Now, part of your system for injecting signals is a so-called bug assembly. You called it a bug, the thing that created 50 dB of isolation. Does it have a more formal name than bug? Because I'm going to be referring to it quite often in my next few conversations. Tell me what's the formal name for that. Signal injector, signal isolator, bug? Bug maybe is the common usage that people in industry really call it. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I never heard of it referred to as a bug. It's actually called an RF cap. Made by Bird. I have to pick one up. I mean, you can still buy them brand new, but I had to pick one up at a flea market like probably, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, and I was attending flea markets a lot more than I am now. And just like you, you see something and you know exactly what you got, and you know that the price on it is worth picking it up at $25, whatever the guy wanted for on the table. And I knew it was worth a lot more than that, so I scoffed it up, and it ended up being a very handy thing to do, to use. I happened to set it, because primarily most of my measurements are done at 450, so at, say, like 500 megahertz, I preset the tap to give me about a 50 dB drop by loading the tap with a 50 ohm connector on the termination on the output of the device. The input goes to a signal generator putting out, you know, so much power, and I look for a 50 dB differential on the output connector, which is a BNC, female. And you just you slide the connector, that tube, in and out of the tap, and then lock in place with a neural nut. And I locked in place once I got my 50 dB of drop at 450. And of course, I know it changes as you go to a higher frequency. You go up to you go up to 800 megahertz, it drops down to maybe 42 to 45 dB a drop. You go down to VHF, it can go as high as 65 dB a drop because. I'm paying attention to my timer tonight. You go down to VHF because it's acting like a capacitor, a fixed capacitor. Your isolation goes up to 65 or so. I've even tested it down at HF frequencies, and the assertion goes up to like 95 to 100. So it's not really usable at HF unless I readjust the tap. But I primarily don't use it there. I primarily use my tap at UHF. But it's a tap, and it's not like a directional coupler. Because you can look at your full power, and you can put a signal back into the thing, unlike a directional coupler, which is kind of putting a signal back into the port. So if you're pushing away, taking a signal out or something, or putting a signal back into something, I've used this in both cases under that type of measurement. So it works very handy. I believe it's called an RF tap. It's made by Bird Electronics, same guys that make the RF Bird 43 meter.
Does it look like that slug with a BNC connector on it?
Looks like a slot? No, doesn't look like a slot at all. This thing is sellable with changeable, interchangeable connectors on the main body. You can take the N female and N male connectors off, and you can put TNC connectors on, male and female. Or you can put some other variety of connectors on it. I've seen them. I think they sell it, and they actually sell it like a kit where you can get different assemblies on the input side and output side. But the tap is always a 50 ohm, is always a BNC female. That doesn't change. That stays as part of the body of the connector.
Now, what I was asking, does it look like a slug? That's how we use you know, like the element that you put into the round hole of your model 43 and it's got a BNC connector on it.
No, doesn't look like that at all. I've seen that type of thing you're talking about. Doesn't look like that at all.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Now, why was somebody stepping on me?
No, you timed out.
You timed out, and various people were trying to reset the machine. But we heard everything you were saying on the input. Okay, RF cap. And made by Bird. And replaceable connectors on the ends. You can make it mate with the TNC, BNC, UHF, Type N, probably SC, and who knows how many other kinds of connectors on the two ends. And you don't have to have the two ends matching each other. Is this thing approximately 2 inches long from end to end, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW?
Why should you look it up on the internet? That's exactly about what it is. It's about 2 inches long. Maybe I say about 3 inches totally. I'm actually from end connector to end connector. And the tap is about maybe 1 1/4 inches to half total height of the tap. You can go look it up on the website or just put an RF tap on Google. You'll probably come up with a picture of it right away. The most common configuration that you'll see it is an end female on one side, an end male on the other side, because that's mostly what people use it for. You know, end connector terminations coming and going.
I know what he's talking about. I have several of them. They come in a different form. Some of them have a little knob on the top with a little lever that lets you tighten it. And it's got an end female and then male and a BNC for the tap output.
Yeah, the BNC tube that slides in and out, which actually just simply looks like a pin. It's actually a little solder blob at the end of this thing, and it doesn't touch the center pin at all. And that's the thing that moves in and out. I've already tested it. You can go down to about maybe 20 dB of isolation, 15 to 20, all the way up to like 70 or 80 or 90 if you want to pull the thing out all the way. But I happen to send it at 50 because 50 is an easy number to remember. And if 100 watts of power is 50...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, that time you only timed out for about 3 seconds or so, Joe. You keep picking up without waiting for the four beeps, and maybe you're not hearing the beeps, but you keep picking up without waiting for the beeps, and therefore you've timed out either 2 or 3 times tonight. But we've gotten the gist of everything you're saying. That so-called RF tap is a very handy device. It's a pure 50-ohm feed-through device. My guess is, under normal circumstances, its insertion loss is numbers like 0.02 dB, essentially zero. You could put a kilowatt through that thing and it'll run ice cold. But because it's got this capacitive tap off to one side with a great big gap going over to the BNC connector, by adjusting the length of that rod that's the center conductor of that BNC connector, you can adjust how close it is to the main feed-through center conductor, therefore how much coupling capacitance you get for the tap. And you can adjust that in your case from 20 dB of isolation all the way up to 90 dB of isolation. Now, what's really happening, what's going to follow right now, for some of the guys listening are going to say, hey, why are you getting so technical? There's a real point about what I'm about to make. Even if you don't understand some of the details, by hearing the words, you will get most of the concept. Don't be afraid by the fact that we're going to give you a bunch of technical data. But there's a real chunk of interesting physics going on here. And so I did the calculation for 2 meters. It doesn't matter whether it's 2 meters or 450 per se. How much voltage is being fed through and how much capacitance is required to do it is the first calculation. And that comes up with something very exciting in my mind. Let me drop and explain. Assume you want to set that tap for 50 dB of isolation. The majority of the signal, 99.999% of the signal, feeds straight through, just like it does on a Bird wattmeter. The Bird wattmeter, the slug, samples a little bit of the power that's being fed through. The slug is a directional coupler. This thing is a non-directional coupler. It's a simple probe, not too different from the probe that's on a slotted line, but there's not a slotted line. You can adjust the depth of this probe, which adjusts the amount of capacitance of the coupling. And in order to get 50 dB of isolation, for each volt you put into the RF tap, you want the sample port to give you 3.16 millivolts. So if you put in 1 volt, and out of the tap, 1 volt being fed through into, let's say, a 50-ohm dummy load, and if the tap is giving you 3.16 millivolts, when compared to 1 volt, is 50 dB of isolation. That's roughly what, a 300-to-1 ratio. 300-to-1 ratio, approximately, of voltage is 50 dB of isolation. Now, what amount of capacitance does that? The amount of capacitance that gives you 115.7 kilo-ohms of capacitor reactance, almost 16 kilo-ohms. 16,000 ohms of capacitive reactant, no matter what frequency you're on, 16,000 ohms of capacitive reactants on that tap will give you a 50 dB isolation if the tap is loaded with 50 ohm load, which it should be. What I've said so far, does that seem to make some sense, Joe? Because I'm about to build on that. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I've called it an RF sampler.
Okay, RF sampler, RF tap, both very good words. Anybody have any comments before I proceed? You're about to see something kind of exciting. K2RIW listening.
I understand where you're going with this. I do understand. I've never tried to measure the capacity of the tap because it's really unimportant to me. I tried to, you know, do a simple meat and potatoes measurement and put so much in and get so much out. That's what I was really interested in doing because that was the important thing to make sure I didn't have the tap set too lightly and ended up having too much signal being introduced in the tap that could damage the instrument.
Good information, Joe. But you made a guess. You thought that I'm about to tell you to measure the capacitance. Absolutely not. I'm telling you to measure the capacitance. But we're going to calculate the capacitance that does that for a very good reason. Okay, so as long as the capacitive reactance on that tapped port of this RF sampler, RF injector, call it what you like, RF tap, as long as it gives you a little bit less than 16,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, between that tapped port and the main straight-through line, you will have 50 dB of isolation, assuming the tapped port is loaded with a 50-ohm resistive load, okay? 15,000 ohms, a naive person would say, gee, if I had 100 ohms on my end of my 50-ohm transmission line, that is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The simple calculation people do is to say 50 ohms divided into 100, 2-to-1, I'm going to get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Or, conversely, if my load is 25 ohms, now you do the division the other way. You always divide the small number into the big number. 25 ohms into 50 again gives you a 2-to-1 visual. So 25 ohms on the end of a line, 2-to-1 visual. 100 ohms on the end of the line, 2-to-1 visual in both cases. But there's a catch. That very simple calculation is true if and only if the 100 ohms is a pure resistive 100 ohms, or the 25 ohms is a pure resistive 100 ohms. This particular bug tapping device, this signal injector, RF tap, is a capacitive sampling device. Even though it's got 15K of capacitive reactant, you divide 50 ohms into 15K, you think you have a 380-to-1 standing wave ratio. Absolutely not true. Let me shut
the repeater. Time out.
It's not a 380-to-1 standing wave ratio. You don't divide the 50 ohms into the 15.7K in this case because it's a capacitor. Let me show you what's happening here. When it comes to transmission lines, they are extremely sensitive to reactants more than a resistance error. A resistance error, if you've got 100 ohms instead of 50 ohms, you get a 2-to-1 visual. You get a little bit of an effect because of a resistive error. If you've got a reactive error, the detriment builds up a hell of a lot faster. And here's the best example I can think of. One of the best puzzles you can give to any of your RF mavens, if you're talking to somebody who's been working in the RF world for 15 years, you've been adjusting transmitters, receivers, repeaters, doing design, doing antenna improvements and whatever. You ask them this particular puzzle, you'll be amazed the answers that you get. Here's the puzzle. Let me drop it. I got a perfect 50-ohm line into a perfect 50-ohm connector going into a very small mini box. Inside the mini box, I've got a very ideal air variable capacitor. At my operating frequency, which might be 100 megacycles, I carefully adjust the air variable capacitor for exactly 50 ohms of capacitive reactance. So I've got nothing in the box but an ideal air 50-ohm capacitor in a shielded box fed with a 50-ohm cable. So to repeat, 50-ohm cable, 50-ohm load, which is a capacitor. That particular network, you ask your favorite RF engineer, what is the standing wave ratio? 90% of them will say it's a 50-ohm load on a 50-ohm cable. It's a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. 90% of them will say that, 85%. I've asked this to a whole lot of people, some people who have been in the world of RF, high-power electronics, military electronics, 20, 30 years. You frequently get that answer. 50-ohm load, 50-ohm cable, it's got to be a 1-to-1. Absolutely not. Let me drop. If what was in the box was a 50-ohm dummy load, and you were feeding 10 watts into it, the box would get hot. 10 watts worth of heat, so to speak, would be happening. In the case of this 50-ohm capacitor reactant, you feed 10 watts into it, it's going to run ice cold. Obviously, all of the power you put in gets reflected. You cannot continuously put power into an ideal capacitor. If it's got no series resistance to it, it absorbs no power. That 50-ohm capacitor inside of that box gives you exactly a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Every single bit of the power you pour into the box comes reflecting back out. That gives you a hint that transmission lines are very sensitive to reactants, whether it be inductive or capacitive, doesn't matter. A reactant's very sensitive to it. Because you've got, in this particular case, of now this RF injecting device, this RF tap, you've got a 15,711 is the amount of capacitive reactance to give you a 50 decibel cap. When you go through the real mathematics of that, it turns out to be a standing wave ratio of 98,741. Let's call it 99,000. You have a standing wave ratio on that RF tapping device of yours at that point of 90,000 standing wave ratio. I've never heard a number that high. You put your, let me drop this. You put your ideal vector network analyzer or your antenna analyzer on that tapping port. When it's installed into a real antenna system, you use it under real working conditions. Your antenna analyzer will tell you you've got a capacitor reactance of 15,000, 16,000 ohms. It'll tell you that it's a 0.06, if you're doing it at 2 meters, it's a 0.069 picofarads. 69 femtofarads is the amount of capacitor. It's a very small capacitor. You would have one third of that would be 33 femto, 0.023. It would be 0.023 capacitance reactance of picofarads if you were doing it at 432. But it's a pure capacitor with a tiny bit of resistance connected to it, the 50 ohms on the other side, so to speak. 98,000 to 1 standing wave ratio. It's not the 380 you do with a simple calculation of dividing 50 ohms of impedance of the cable into a 15,000 ohm capacitor reactance. Because it's a capacitor, it acts very differently. Now that gives you a little bit of a gut feeling, Joe. Let me drop. When your standing wave ratio on that end of your sampling cable is a 98,000 to 1 standing wave ratio at that point, I get a little bit more feeling of why the length of that cable is very sensitive and the frequency you're feeding through that system is very sensitive. You're starting off with a huge standing wave ratio on one end, and even if the other end was perfectly matched, you're going to get some strange characteristics. So, capacitive reactance or inductive reactance on the end of a transmission line has a hell of a lot more effect. Another way of viewing this, when you look at the Brown and Woodward curves, and the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis on one set of curves is the capacitive reactance, another set of curves is the resistance. When you look at what happens when you change the frequency a whole lot, the resistance moves very slowly. The capacitive reactance of a monopole antenna moves very rapidly. The standing wave ratio you see go above or below the tuned frequency of your dipole is primarily reactance that's doing it. That's where the real standing wave ratio is coming from. Let me drop. That gives you a little bit more of a hint of why when you make the antenna at a very wide set of sheet metal, a UHF antenna, and you use wide strips to make the driven element and the directors, why the bandwidth of the antenna improves so fast is because you're doing something that